the person's eyes that have the answers in. Around the galaxy, Mars, a new place to begin. White light, my telescope.
So anyway, Richard, like, wait, I don't want to take too much of your time because I appreciate you being here. You know, the general aim of this new show is like psychonautics, and your new book is even really focused on that, like elucidating the science of that. And so I know it's kind of like an ass backwards way of like getting into your work, but you know, I've already talked to you twice and we've approached conversations in a normal way before. So maybe we can start at the back end and kind of work our way forward. So start with like the Vajra sequence and maybe how you're developing that and your ideas on that.
Well, you know, it's interestingly enough, it's not a backwards progression to start at the, I guess, what I would call my first inspiration towards any of the things that I've written. Because in my younger days, it was not uncommon to experiment with, you know, various kinds of psychedelics, and I was no different. I mean, I'm the same age as Steve Jobs would have been. Steve Jobs had those kinds of experiences, and we both followed, you know, technology paths that were not dissimilar. I've often said that the psychedelic era, that early psychedelic era, was really an inspiration for the birth of a lot of the things that we see today in digital media, you know, the internet, virtual reality, you name it, all of that sort of a legalized version of the psychedelic inspiration of the 60s and 70s. So for me, interference theory, the first book that I wrote, I guess it's been 8 or 9 years when I started that, was actually something that I had begun back in the 70s. And it was based upon some visions that I had of what I would call, you know, I thought of at the time as the fabric of reality. And I think more than anything, it was really the fabric of perception, you know, that it's really the perceiver who is a mirror of all of that in the first place. And the things that one sees are hints or clues as to how the human mind works, how the body's structured, how reality functions, physics. I mean, everything comes out of that. And that was really what interference was about. It was an attempt to explore that connection between perception and everything else. Because that's the big thing that science hasn't really done a very good job of doing and really largely avoided until more recent years and usually the more, you know, radical elements within the scientific community. But that perception really should be at the center of it. And that's the biggest mystery. If you can solve that, everything else falls into place pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely part of the problem is incorporating the subjective experience into what we would term science or something similar. And psychonautics really is an effort towards that end. And it's a very old idea, but it's always undergoing revisions. And we have our modern conceptions of it. And like you just mentioned, technology is a waking psychedelic experience for people and they don't realize it. So they don't really have ownership of it as much as they consume it. And in that sense, you mentioned that psychedelics added to the experience or at least acted as a catalyst. And others I've talked to say, well, yes, that's a tool, but also we have other ways of accessing that plane. And that's what's so interesting about this field is there's so many different avenues of approaching it. And so it's so hard to categorize and label. And so it doesn't really conform to our reductionist state of mind. Is that right or wrong?
Well, yeah. I mean, for me these days, more than anything, dreams, lucid dreams are a big part of it. And that's a whole discussion unto itself. But to be specific, and I guess, I mean, we can talk in generalities, but for me, it's a very specific thing that led to the path that I followed, you know, both in my career as well as in my writing. And that is that when I had these experiences, I would see something pretty much every time. And that was when I would look at a surface, I would see what I described at the time as a seething sort of wave matrix. It was interlocking sine and cosine waves that would essentially, you know, intermesh and sort of throb and that sort of thing. And in the meshing of those, it would come patterns. Out of that mesh would come patterns. And there was a pink and a light green kind of opposing color aura or sense that was in this interference pattern that I was seeing. It got me very interested. I actually, you know, was so sort of perplexed by this that one morning I was having a dream and I visualized this this oscillating wave system with while I was still partially asleep, visualized this with musical notes hovering over a certain area, you know, lined up over the waves. And I could imagine my hands playing the piano, because I'm a pianist, playing the piano inside these waves, like you'd stick my hand into these waves and music would come out, you know. And so I started, I woke up that morning and I drew what I'd seen down on, literally on an envelope, which is the only thing that was close to me. I don't know where I was that night, but that's the only thing I found. And that's what I started studying, started trying to come up with systems that would help me explain this vision that I was having in these altered states. And I got interested again in trigonometry, because that's the math of waves. And so I actually took a class in trig and then started, you know, taking more math classes. And I started programming an Apple II computer. I was introduced to a man who invented the digital synthesis chip on the Speak and Spell, the Texas Instruments Speak and Spell, which was the first digital synthesis toy or anything. And he had just gotten an Apple II, and I was introduced. I went over to his house. He was an old, fat, bald man, lived alone, is really a very eccentric fellow. And he had toys, you know, that he would buy and pile up in the corner all the way to the ceiling in his living room, or actually it was in his dining room. And whenever he got bored, he'd just get a toy and take it apart and figure out how it works. Well, this is the kind of guy he was. And he had an Apple II that had just come out. And I showed him, I had drawn these wave patterns and these matrices with different patterns in them that were musical patterns, but they were geometries also. And I'd drawn these on transparencies that you used to use in overhead projectors. That's the only way that I could overlay different layers. At the time, there, you didn't have personal computers and graphics and all the things that came after that. And I started showing him this. And then there was one, the last one was a really interesting one, where a certain musical pattern in this matrix of waves would create a little human face. And I couldn't figure out how something like music could create a human face. This we're talking about 1978. Okay. And he that kind of stunned him a little bit. He didn't really understand it either. But, you know, because these ideas that we all kind of share now, that's kind of part of the zeitgeist, it was unknown at the time, you know, except for musings that somebody might have in an altered state. So, you know, we sat down and we programmed that night, all night, on his Apple II to try to reproduce some of this. And I did that a couple of more times with him. And then he was, you know, he became less interested, and I needed to get more direct control. So I got my own Apple II and started learning how to machine program, which is what you had to do to get graphic animation at the time. and then realized that computers were not fast enough to even begin to keep up with music. So I, you know, I went into studying computer science in graduate school and started down a career in computers until they started to catch up in the early 90s. And that's when I started getting back into it. But you see, the inspiration was a, it was psychedelic experiences that literally became what I would call visual music using computers. And this, you know, this, and here we are today, where it seems like everybody, there's so many people that are creating all kinds of sacred geometry and musical expressions of geometry and stuff like that, that was just absolutely, you know, unknown and would have been considered, you know, completely wacky in those days. And I see it all as an outgrowth of the, of, you know, that, those kinds of psychedelic experiences that people of my generation had during those days.
So Richard, you did a great job of giving that story of integration in your earlier years. And I was wondering if you have any similar stories for your upcoming works or even from the Venus Blueprint, if things that you were doing at the Roslyn location were also similarly influenced by psychedelic experiences.
Mm-hmm. Well, the interesting thing about Interference and then also with the Venus Blueprint was that as I was writing those, you know, in the case of Interference Theory, I was coming at it strictly from a sort of scientific musical perspective. There really was no, there were hints of psychedelic experience in the things that I was talking about, but no direct reference, I don't believe, to any kind of experiences like that in Interference. In the Venus Blueprint, I did not set out to end up where that book took me, which was into psychoactive, you know, communions, entheogens, as it was used in ancient religions. I started off on that purely from a perspective of continuing from Interference, applying harmonic theory to the geometry and acoustics of Roslyn Chapel. And that had developed somewhat in parallel with Interference, and so it was natural to go off into that and explore that some more and take a trip over and do all the things that I did. But it was a natural thing to come to the conclusion that, oh my goodness, this architecture has some sort of psychoacoustical effect on the brain, and why would they be doing that? And of course, as I'm asking those questions, I'm finding studies at UCLA and Princeton where they've found that certain frequencies have certain effects on the brain, and also that the frequencies that they're finding in one school and the other, they're finding that there were ancient structures, some of the oldest structures that were hitting some of those same frequencies. And so it sort of evolved into a natural question of why would they be doing this? And so there was a bridging process there between my harmonic and acoustic theory and geometry and geometrical theories about that structure and about other sacred spaces into the communions that were used within those spaces. And I came to the conclusion that the temples, that the reason that they built temples with psychoacoustical effects is because they were, you know, doing some sort of entheogens and going in there and chanting, and the resonant frequencies, were having, you know, those, some of those spaces were tuned to were having a enhancing effect on the, entheogenic communions they were taking. So it's a focusing effect is pretty much how I saw it, is that it is very similar to, the votives, the icons, you know, the statues and things like that, that they would use to also help focus and produce, I believe, certain types of visions. So they would do their communion, they would chant and look at these icons and try to invoke, you know, a god or a goddess of one sort in their visions. I mean, this was all about, you know, trying to communicate with sky gods and the earth gods and goddesses, And so this was, I came to understand all of that as sort of this advanced ancient technology for psychonautics, and that they're all integrated. They're all part of a mixed media brain, you know, mind technology or spirit technology. And of course, there were other things too. There would be things like incantations and meditation. You know, they, as I found in Roslyn, there's a good possibility that they would heat up some of these chambers to certain frequencies in order to resonate differently, because the hotter the air or the cooler the air, there's different prime resonant frequencies, even within the same space. And so there was a whole host of things, I think, that were being used, and probably in different places they would use different technologies. But I do believe that at the core of it was an attempt to focus this visionary, religious visionary experience, and to envision the particular gods or goddesses that they wanted to see.
Well, and there's this parallel story of just the threshold effects of DMT that Terence McKenna often talked about the tone that is encountered, and also so much of the imagery being drawn to vaulted architecture and halls and cathedrals, and in the same way that just parallels exactly what you're saying about that happening on site in a physical place.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I, you know, all of this stuff is, for me, is kind of coming together, and none of it was intentional. It was just following a natural series or sequence of questions. You know, once you sort of answered one question relatively well, then it would lead you to another question, and you just kept doing that. And that's really the road that I'm on, is it's none of it's really planned. It's a combination of intuition and research, and letting research, you know, answer some questions, but then bring up new questions and just follow the trail wherever it leads me and write about it as I go. And the writing is helpful in that it helps me organize my thoughts, and wherever I can create a system or a theoretical context, some sort of framework, you know, for people to fit this into other things that they may already know. So all of that led me to imagine, towards the last part of the Venus Blueprint, imagine a future science that would be a psychonautic science that would combine, you know, the best of the kind of technologies, digital technologies and other cognitive, you know, psychological technologies that we know about with some of the ancient traditions, and to use those in some combination of ways. And the best way to do that was to write a science fiction novel that paints this, you know, this future picture that science is, I believe, going to undergo, you know, a massive transformation, you know, not necessarily away from the outer world to the inner world, but a new science of inner exploration. You know, the thing that's stopping it, there's still a lot of barriers in the way in science to keep that from happening, both that and in, you know, society at large, with these substances being illegal and so forth. So there's got to be quite a few paradigm changes, I think, before something like that can pop up. But, you know, this new book is exploring how that science might be born and how it might be developed.
Well, Richard, what do you think the benefits are of that? I hear, or I have heard this from the past, like, what is the utility of exploring another dimension? So let's say psychics can explore this dimension, or people engaging in ritual can engage with this dimension or this larger system that we're a part of. But then the question becomes, oh, well, what's the utility? And I don't think many people, well, I think many people that might be listening grasp this idea, but maybe people that are new to it don't grasp the tradition of actually bringing back useful information from these experiences, both to help either people in your community, or more explicitly or usual, is to help ourselves. I mean, it's like a process of self-development and self-knowledge and self-growth. And from that comes more right action and so on. But yeah. I guess what is first and foremost in your mind in that equation?
The first and foremost part. I'm not really sure what would be first and foremost, but there's several parallel things that are important, I think. You know, I mean, and they're all equally important in different ways, I guess. You know, the one thing, if science had a field of psychonautic exploration, and that may be multiple fields, you know, that culminates in these sorts of, you know, quantitative explorations. Well, just the fact, without even considering the effects of the people, you know, on the people, just the fact that science would embrace that. I mean, if it were truly a formal science that people took seriously, it would open the door to bridge the gap between science and religion, basically. I mean, they're both dogmatic, but if you just take the dogma out, the schism that developed during really the early Enlightenment, where harmonic theory was cast aside, it was that's why we have humanities that's separate, you know, from the sciences. There was a split where the only way the scientists could go forward without offending the church would be to take the thing that the church sees as pagan and also as a threat out of it, which is the musical science aspect, the harmonic theory and that sort of thing. And so there was an attempt to sort of, and a successful one, to move the musical sciences off into the arts and, in a sense, drop the science part of it. So if you go to a university today, almost anywhere in the world, it seems, you know, you can study science and you can study music, but you can't study musical science, because that harmonic theory, all of that stuff, is extremely buried in the science side. The music side doesn't even explore it. And that's really where that integration would occur. But if you had the birth of a psychonautic science, it would, I think, inevitably lead to, you know, concepts of resonance as a cognitive function, and start integrating in resonance theories with brain function and that sort of thing. And there's a little bit of that out there, and I know some of the people doing that, but it's so not accepted in the cognitive sciences yet. So I think there's a lot that could happen with psychonautics that would just help break down some of the barriers and the dogma, both in science side and the religion side, because when you start touching on this concept of non-physical realms, well, you're definitely stepping on the toes of religion, and you're definitely breaking the paradigms of current material science. So that's a big, just doing that would be a major thing. Now, in terms of the utility, there's individual utility, and then there could be lots of utility that we can't even imagine right now, because we're so far away from having those experiences being integrated into, you know, Western philosophy and the Western worldview, that we can't really imagine where it would take us. But it can go from as small a thing as the development of intuition, and, you know, much like it did for me, where I had visual experiences that gave me clues about how perception worked and how music worked and how physics had to work in order for that all to fit together. And it led to some discovery there. I think there's lots of that sort of thing. I mean, what is it? Crick, you know, who worked on, you know, developed a lot of the, you know, the DNA sequencing and that sort of thing. You know, he had psychedelic experiences, and he believed that that was the inspiration that allowed him to make that breakthrough. So there's lots of little personal things like that that people would bring back in doing that sort of exploration. There's a larger effect on society if there were actually places, which used to be temples, you know, where people would go to experiment with consciousness, but rather have a new sort of temple that would be places where people could go and experiment with, you know, guides and with all the things that could make for successful sessions. If those sorts of things were to develop, sort of spring up, much like marijuana dispensaries, you know, if you had only, these are places where you would go, like a club, but it would be a therapeutic club, maybe you know, it would have some spiritual aspects to it. But if you had place things like that, then there could be a larger social effect that would counter a lot of the really negative things that are happening. You know, there would be a greater sense of unity. I think more moderate views and more caring views for other people and for the environment and animals and so forth like that. So there could be a transformation of society. So that's a larger aspect. Now, none of those am I really following in the Vajra sequence, this new book? I'm following a different trail, which is the trail that would occur rather rapidly, or could occur rather rapidly, where you have a radical scientist who has developed some mind-altering technology, not using entheogens, but then connects with another scientist who is an expert in ethnobotany and so forth, and that the two start putting these things together, and then they find partner and funding, and it becomes a very large sort of, you know, very well-funded scientific exploration, much like NASA. Now, you know, I propose that's unlikely to happen in the West, and that you would have to go to somehow under the Russian umbrella, you know, in order for something like that to happen quickly, because that's the sort of thing that they've been studying for many years.
Right.
And they would embrace it. And so that's where I go with the book, is that these American and British scientists end up partnering with a Russian funded lab. And the lab is actually something of based on a pyramidal, stepped pyramidal temple kind of complex. So it's very much like a new NASA with a mission control center and all this sort of thing that controls a group of psychonauts that travel together. And in the process, they are, you know, they're visiting different dimensions, a specific sequence of dimensions, and they're using a particular set of technology to basically persuade the entities in these other dimensions to assist them in helping to at least counter, you know, some an increasing violence trend and a potential for war. So there's a connection that I'm making. Now, it's a science fiction book, and I don't know if this sort of connection exists. I know there's a lot of people that believe in it, but I believe that there is a connection between other dimensional, you know, entities and states of mind and, you know, states of the universe that could potentially have an impact back on Earth and vice versa. So I kind of play with that in this story. And of course, the benefit would be to help alleviate or have, you know, affect the consciousness, the global consciousness in a sort of holistic fashion through this interdimensional adventure. So that's whether something like that would happen or not. I mean, it's anybody's guess, but it's the kind of thing that we have just no clue, no idea about. It's much like when we looked up in the sky and just saw these little white dots up there and thought that there was, you know, sort of a sphere around us, and these were holes poked in it, or they were gods or whatever, until we actually explored. And then it completely changed our paradigm of what was out there and how vast it really is. And I think it's exactly the same thing for psychonautics, that we haven't figured out what that paradigm is yet, and it could be anything.
What's really interesting about science today, at least mainstream science today, is that it already admits the existence of other dimensions.
Yes.
Especially with something like string theory, which I have all sorts of problems with, but at the very least, it admits that, okay, there's something beyond what is experienced in our day-to-day senses, and that our senses are not all that there is. But in parallel with that, they're able to support that point of view in their model, because then they say, well, your consciousness is an illusion, though. So when you're dead, it's over, and so on and so forth. So your life really has no meaning beyond the chemical constituents and the electrochemical activity going on that is the only impetus for your entire consciousness experience. So I think the idea for them of exploring consciousness makes no sense because they don't even think consciousness is a real thing. Whereas I think we, on the other hand, admit that there is a certain level of objectivity to it. That is it's an entity. It might even be the primordial thing that everything comes out of. We may very well be consciousness itself. So there's no way to really completely untangle these questions, but at the same time, especially something like the psychedelic experience or the synchronistic experience, and you know, everything you're saying, Richard, it goes hand in hand with something like synchrony or synchromysticism, and same kind of principle where you're reading the signs, engaging kind of with the larger super system in this sort of subliminal, symbolic, deep way. And so, yeah, that, like you said, there's a lot of ways to go about this kind of exploration, and the paradigm is still open-ended, but that's what's so interesting and exciting about it.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say that you're right. Science is not going to just suddenly sort of embrace some new thing on its own accord. It's going to have to be forced to deal with it. And that's kind of what I'm speculating with in this book is, you know, how would something like that occur and develop quickly? As opposed to over, you know, 100, 200, 300 years, whatever it would take for science to finally give up. I mean, it's several generations, I guess, you know. So I'm imagining what could occur. And as I found in my own technology career, that technology is actually the most destructive thing for whatever the existing paradigm is. You know, I mean, the incredible change that has occurred in my lifetime with computers, the internet, mobile communications, and the like is earth-shattering. It's completely obliterated many businesses and still will continue to obliterate more businesses to transform society, you know, full of people who really don't have jobs. You know, how is that going to work? And it's the technology that's doing it. You know, everybody's so concerned about all the political stuff. And it's like, that's not the stuff that's really going to make a difference. You know, The technology is going to cut. Some technologies are going to come along and they're going to be extremely disruptive and completely reinvent the world for everybody, whether they like it or not. And I think that, you know, that's the kind of thing I'm exploring with Vajra's sequences, that, you know, maybe there is a little thread of things that could occur that could bring about a vast change, you know, and essentially force science to change as a result. So anyway, that's what I was going to say about that.
Richard, I wanted to ask you a question about your experience as an author and how you've moved from the Venus Blueprint into the Vajra sequence and in working from this analytical mode to the fictional realm, how that may have opened your eyes to anything, or if you've learned anything from making that transition. You know, in the Venus Blueprint, when reading that, some of the truths that you find are stranger than fiction. So I'd like to hear your ideas on the difference between these two modes of writing.
Right. Well, there was also a big change between Interference, which was more of a scientific, you know, formalized exploration, and the Venus Blueprint, which is really a personal adventure. It did have some analytical things about it, but it was also a social or an anthropological kind of book as well. It had multiple dimensions that Interference didn't. And so the Vajra sequence is yet again another big shift from both of those. But it's the only place I could go to, you know, project what the future might be. Because I've been backward looking with both Interference and the Venus Blueprint. And this one, it definitely has some backward looking stuff, because there's, you know, there's a part of the story is researching, you know, certain museums or certain methods that were used by the ancients to, you know, develop their psychonautic technology. And so there was some of the same kinds of things that I did in the other books in this one, but it's just being applied through a story and character development and that sort of thing. So the thing I like about fiction as opposed to nonfiction is that it's easier to paint, you know, a speculative picture without worrying about somebody nailing you on, you know, whether that's how possible or how real that is, you know, because we're dealing with something that has yet to be defined as real, for at least from a scientific perspective. And so it's easy for me to, for instance, a lot of the, there are studies, psychedelic studies out there where subjects, you know, have taken certain doses and then they, you know, they go off, have these experiences and then come back and are debriefed on what they saw. And then after enough of those are done, then there's reviews of, well, how many people had this kind of experience? How many people saw that? How many people did this? And, you know, like Rick Straussman and his work. And so those are all, to the people that had the experiences, they're real experiences. Mostly they say, you know, they're even more real than reality. And so the best way for me to hook those kinds of experiences into the development of a future science was through the characters in this story, through a storyline that essentially takes somebody by the hand as they're reading it and walks them through a scenario of discovery, both in ancient as well as current technologies for mind altering, for mind alteration, and how they might could be put together to create something greater than either one. And so the characters in the story and, you know, help me tell that and help, you know, make it interesting for people to read so that it doesn't become, you know, kind of a boring lecture. And that was what I discovered when I wrote the Venus Blueprint. And actually what the publisher commented on in that was that he didn't see very many books that were really telling that, you know, about that kind, about ancient technologies and things through a first person exploratory adventure sort of thing that I did in Venus Blueprint. And that really made a difference, he thought, in how people could absorb the information and enjoy it, you know, as they're reading it. And so I think, you know, the Vajra sequence takes it one step further into, you know, a complete science fiction framework. There's lots and lots of facts, lots of true facts, more true facts in this science fiction than I think in most science fiction books. Not just science facts, but also anthropological facts, that there's enough of that kind of information that's at the core of the story and of the character's own revelations that somebody reading it might feel like, okay, this, there's a lot of real stuff here. I can't really tell the difference between things that aren't, that might not be real and things that clearly are. That, I think, enhances believability, and it might help people take some of the psychedelic scenes more seriously, because I gradually introduce those in an experimental way, as if, you know, you or I were beginning to experiment with certain, you know, technology, cognitive technologies, and or, you know, plant or fungus type, you know, communions and that sort of thing. And you start messing, you start playing with that stuff, and you start noticing some things, you start learning some things, and you start putting two and two together, and you gradually grow this technology. And that's what I do in the book, to help people see how the two fit together and how they can kind of organically, you know, develop. So that's why the fictional aspect, and it's been hard, believe me, it's taken me long, much longer than I would like, because it's everything that I do for a nonfiction book in terms of collecting facts and, but I have to figure out how to fit them together into a futuristic scenario. And I have to develop the characters and let the characters say, you know, say these things and teach themselves these things. So it's like several different, you know, several different things all at once.
There are a lot more subjective decisions to make as well.
Yeah, there are, but I try, you're right. And that's in the character development and setting, scene setting, and all of the, you know, classical things that you do when you write a piece of fiction. But I mean, this will be my first. Well, I wrote a graphic novel, that was a novelette, and I didn't really sell it. but that was fictional, but it was just not, it was, you know, very, very elementary, and because it was mostly about the graphics and I was just having fun with it. But this is a, you know, this is a serious undertaking, my first real serious undertaking in fiction. So we'll see. I think it is going to be very compelling. I think that people like the other things I've written, and if they like other, you know, sorts of adventure type things, this one is a psychedelic adventure. I mean, there's things going on in the real world, and there's things going on in the non-physical world in this book, and they are bouncing back and forth and blending, which is the thing that makes it fun. That there's feedback and relationships between these non-physical realms and the physical in this. So
I like the concept of that, because, you know, there's the literature out there that seems so far from reality. Just taking Harry Potter and saying, you know, this is a world of magic, but really there is a whole other world of magic out there that is so real. I mean, in that sense, you have science fiction going, but in a way it is also reality. So I love that path.
That's right. Yeah. And that was the only path I could take, you know, from where I was, where I got at the end of the Venus Blueprint, the only place I could go. I mean, I do have another book that is another nonfiction that is currently called Harmonic Evolution. And I have a lot of material for that. And I thought that when I was writing Venus Blueprint that I would go back to that. And get that. And I think that will be an important book, because it explores a whole other aspect of the harmonic theory in integrating and really treating the human body and really life in general as a liquid crystal structure. And how does it self-organize according to, you know, harmonic physics and that sort of thing. And, there really is a missing link there in Darwinian theory that says, you know, everything is really pretty random and a survival, you know, environment that things are tuned to that. Yet there's no explanation for the kinds of organizations of life forms in that theory. It's just swept aside. And I can reverse engineer the structure of the human body and see a wave lattice and, you know, interference patterns and harmonic relationships, Fibonacci relationships, obviously. All of that stuff is there, unaddressed by Darwinian theory. And I think that Darwinian theory is correct, but it's incomplete. And there needs to be this whole physics side of things that has to do with resonance that helps explain how cells self-organize. So I'm still going to go and work on that when I'm finished with this one. But the Vajra sequence, you know, the idea of just following the ancient path forward through the technology and sciences that we have into something new was just too compelling for me to not go ahead and pursue it, you know, and my passion was there. So that's what I did.
Okay. So you brought up Darwinism, so I can't help but go there, because that's always a topic that I'm interested in. And I agree with you that it's a correct theory in its limited domain, sort of like Newtonianism was for physics and is for physics. It's right to a limited degree, but then there's got to be something more to that. It's obvious, but when we build entire institutions and, I guess, celebrities around a subject matter, it dies kind of hard, or it barely changes, or it takes a lot to change it. So it undertakes this sort of inertia, this intellectual inertia and this academic inertia. And so it resists change. But like you just mentioned, if you go to DNA, it doesn't explain morphogenesis in a very satisfactory way at all. And in fact, forms and what have you, again, follow a sort of archetypal form according to, again, these development patterns that you're referencing that are harmonic and based in almost like these mystery schools and so on and so forth. Yes. So you can trace this back again, like this intersection of spirit and science. It's very interesting. And you see very few people talk about the liquid crystal organism like you do. I've seen you do it. I've seen one other woman do it, Maewon Ho, who's a biochemist, brilliant actually, and wrote The Rainbow and the Worm, The Physics of Organisms. And she gets into the implicate order and fractal space-time and how this impacts the formation of currents in the electrical body and creates kind of like the electrical universe that we see and feel around us. Now, you do come at it from a different angle and put a whole different spin on it. And so, but there, I see these intersections and just that whole concept of, again, self-organizing liquid crystal. Again, humans are what? I'm forgetting the exact percentage of what we are in water, but I mean, we're mostly fluid, but we're solid, but we're not. It's a very strange balance, you know, where you exist between order and chaos. Yeah. So I don't know, maybe you can go off that.
Well, yeah, 86% of the atoms in our bodies are water, hydrogen and oxygen, and 12% is carbon 12, and the remaining is mostly nitrogen, which is, you know, a percent and a half or something. And then the rest of it is just a mix of lots of different minerals. But so we are a carbon water crystal. And the geometry that our body takes is determined by the interaction of those molecules, those elements. And just like in, you know, crystallization in minerals. And there is a structure to water, even when it's not crystallized, you know, frozen. If it's very, very calm, very pure, it will organize itself into very weak liquid crystals. So there is this tendency for, you know, everything matter to crystallize according to some polarity, and that's determined by the makeup, you know, the atomic makeup of whatever it is. And why wouldn't that be the case? Why wouldn't Darwinian theory embrace that universal physics? And why wouldn't they use words that are applied to crystals like a crystal radio? Well, how does that crystal radio work? Well, the crystal resonates, you know, and, you know, that's what everything does. It's all in some state of resonance and some sort of state of vibration. Now, whether it resonates into standing waves or they're just spread spectrum waves that are ambient or whatever, at some point there's a container, and within that container there's some order that is determined, you know, by its shape and viscosity and its reflective features, characteristics. And the body is such a container. The reason that we have a body is because this cellular process, this growth process, occurs under great pressure of the atmosphere, which is pressurized under gravity and so forth. And so we're like little liquid bubbles that crystallize into particular geometries based on the makeup of our DNA and, you know, the things that are controlling that unfolding process. But it's definitely within a pressurized environment. And even in the solar system itself, you know, there's pressure that's, you know, densest in the sun, and it's got its heliosphere, which is a little disc bubble in effect that creates a pressurized sphere around the sun that, you know, that causes the planets to form in the way that they do, and they resonate. Create little resonances among themselves as the plasma was forming into planets and moons. And this is a universal process. So the evolutionary process, this is another hole really in Darwinian evolution theory, is it starts at the molecular level. It doesn't have a way to incorporate the evolution of a planet or a solar system or a galaxy. It doesn't link evolution outside of just this biological phenomenon that has occurred. And therefore, you know, again, there's no big picture that people are able to make decisions by or to use as guides to explore further. They just kind of, you know, it's like I like to say, science is a bunch of people in this huge dark warehouse, pitch black warehouse, and they've all got little pin lights and they're walking around examining the little area that's in the light of their pin light. They have no idea what's in the pin light of all these other people, much, much less what kind of room they're in. And they're just searching around in the dark. They don't have any guiding philosophy. You know, they like to think that the scientific method, which is, by the way, different things, it's actually is come from different perspectives into, you know, into something that's essentially a randomizing kind of thing. You know, it's like if you have a hunch, then, you know, think up a reason why that might be the case and then just experiment. And if you can, you know, and through that process, you will stumble upon, you may stumble upon an answer or you may stumble upon something else. And these days, everybody celebrates this idea that science proceeds by stumbling. You know, if somebody were to say, yes, I'm going to go for a walk and, you know, well, which direction? Well, I don't really know. I think I'll just head over that direction. Well, how are you going to know that you're there when you get there? Well, I don't know. You know, it doesn't matter. And that's kind of the way science works, is just a bunch of people flailing around in the dark. And what I think science needs, and what I've proposed in some things I've written, is it needs a framework that helps guide people in the decision-making process, a framework that we know, you know, is true. We know that things resonate. We know that harmonic theory in some form or another, that's what quantum physics is quantum is harmonic theory, that is present everywhere in some way. We may not know yet how it manifests, but that's a pretty easy framework to make. That's a philosophy. Science is anti-philosophy. And that's, I think, is a failing. I think that a lot of people spend their entire lives chasing things that, you know, are just not true, or not either fundamentally not correct, or, and they'll spend their whole lives doing it.
And don't the science celebrities tell you not to focus? That's philosophy is dead, right? So Lawrence Krauss says philosophy is dead. Stephen Hawking says it's dead. Neil deGrasse Tyson says it's dead. Richard Dawkins says don't pay any attention. So all the high priests of science say that there's nothing worthwhile in philosophical musings, that it's a worthless pursuit, that all we need to do are dot our I's and cross our T's and measure this and do that. Yeah. We don't even know what the hell consciousness is, but hey, let's say that we're going to have the grand unified theory tomorrow, just like we did 100 years ago. And we'll keep saying 100 years from now until we blow our civilization up. So it's all this hubris and ahistorical self-aggrandizement. Yeah. That makes no sense. And, you know, I mean, how can they not understand where they've come from and where they're going? It really shocks me. So in that sense, I'd say that psychonautics is not a solution, but it's a, you know, well, maybe, but it's part of just a bigger evolution of a human thought and human integration. So instead of compartmentalizing these areas of our life and saying, well, I go to church on Sundays and the rest of the time I'm a, you know, I'm this and that in the business world or the science world, and I pretend to have these different motives, but then compartmentalization, it's breaking through that, I think. This is all part of that.
Yeah, I mean they're called doctors for a reason. They defend the doctrine, you know. They're indoctrinated with the doctrine. They believe in that method because it has produced, you know, stumbling around the dark has produced some results. You know,
absolutely. Sure.
Maybe not very efficiently, but it does allow people to kind of think outside the box, since the box is pretty small in current science in a lot of ways. And so it allows people to think outside the box. But ultimately, in order to get published, in order to get tenure or whatever as an academic, you know, you pretty much have to find a way to plug in whatever you're doing, whatever you're interested in, into the existing paradigm. And once you do, and you find some success, the more success you have, the more convinced that you are this is the answer. This is the way things should be done. And to some extent, you know, there's a pragmatic aspect to this, and that is that just because I or somebody else or even a group of people says, here's a philosophy that could be used as a framework, you know, like I, the reason that I come at things the way I do is because I think that the most accessible way for people to understand how the human body, how life works and how physics works is music. You know, you can actually feel the physics emotionally. It actually has an effect on you. And if you understand really what's going on underneath all of that, then you have a deeper respect and a deeper appreciation for the physical processes that are, you know, all around us. flowers and bugs all start looking like music. You know, the more you start seeing those as sort of crystallized music or harmonics, the more, you know, it just changes your entire perspective and appreciation for the world around you. And we're completely devoid of that kind of thing. But just because I say that or somebody else says that isn't going to change anything any more than somebody walking into Congress with a particular ideology is going to cause everything to change. It's everybody has their own perspectives and their own beliefs to defend. And so from a pragmatic point of view, science, you know, is the way it is because of that. You can't get people to agree on any sort of unified framework. So just let them, you know, give them a pen light and let them go hunt.
Sure.
in your all of your study of harmonics and frequencies of sounds, is there a single tone that you've kind of nailed as a most important tone or frequency?
Well, that was kind of a theme in the Venus Blueprint, in that I was looking at totally different things that offered some sort of universal frequencies and that I thought might have an effect on the brain or on the body and that sort of thing. The Schumann resonances in the atmosphere, which, by the way, are maintained by thunderstorms, lightning strikes around the globe at any given time. And that's actually maintaining that Schumann frequency up there. But we're bathed in it. And there are correlations that in scholarly studies that show a correlation between brain wave frequencies and the Schumann resonances. And a scientist generally wouldn't argue that fact. They would see that as a perfectly natural thing, that during a long evolutionary period, being bathed in certain frequencies, that the body would pick those resonances up, you know, sympathetically would be the term they'd use. And that they would be part of the body. So the Schumann resonances are one set of things. And without going into details of that, you know, there's a fundamental of about, 7.8 hertz, somewhere around like that. Some people say it's 8 hertz, you know, that has been slowed down or whatever. But, you know, it depends on when you measure it, but it's within a range there, and that those, that the harmonics off of that and the Schumann resonances correspond to different brain states. So you can multiply any of those harmonics out to get them into the range of musical tones. And when you do, you know, you'll see that they come close to some of these frequencies that have been found to have a psychoactive effect on, you know, switching left brain to right brain function, somewhere around 110, 111 hertz. And there's much higher frequencies, you know, 28,000 hertz, 28 kilohertz has been found to create heart attacks. You know, that for some reason that frequencies in that range will cause the heart to fail if it's frail. And so, you know, there's different frequencies. I found in Roslyn Chapel that Well, there's 423 hertz, somewhere between 423 and 424 hertz, and any octave below or above that. Okay, so anytime anybody would say a frequency like that, then you can just say, well, okay, and all the octaves that would resonate with it, that frequency seems to be a natural frequency at room temperature for a room that would have the, you know, features of, that would have sacred geometry and have a certain multiples of 72, or let's just say 18 feet or 36 feet. And then there, 432 hertz, which is, you know, everybody is very, you know, there's a sort of a new age movement to get 432 to be the new concert pitch. Well, that turns out that you'd have to heat up Roslyn Chapel to the exact temperature of a beehive, which is pretty amazing, which is about 93 degrees Fahrenheit, in order for Roslyn Chapel, which is multiples of this 18 feet or 36 feet, in all directions, you know, to resonate with 432 hertz or the prime frequency, prime resonant frequency, 432 hertz. So you'd have to heat it up. You'd have to get it pretty hot in there in order for that to resonate with 432. But the interesting thing about that, you know, 93 degrees is that's the temperature, you know, of a beehive. Well, there's two beehives that are built into or were built into the top of Roslyn Chapel. And bees are a symbol of Venus, you know, considered the children of Venus. I mean, bees are essentially cherubs, you know, they're putti or whatever. They're the little flying children of Venus. And so there is this strange connection between those things in the Venus blueprint that just were kind of perplexing to me, because you say, well, okay, did they know this or did they not know it, or how might they have come to that? Is it purely coincidental? But there's a lot of, and so I explore those questions as best I could at the time in the Venus blueprint, but you know, that's where you kind of get this idea that, okay, well, there's normal sort of secular everyday frequencies, and then there's these sacred frequencies that, you know, that would tune to sacred geometries. And then, of course, once you get into any of that, you have to say, well, what units are you using and why? And that's, you know, I came to the conclusion that the metric of a foot is not just, you know, based on the measure of somebody's foot, even though that might actually relate to what I think it is. And it seems to relate to the speed of sound and at certain temperatures. And that's what is the masons that built all these ancient temples and cathedrals. I think that they were trying to create an instrument, you know, like a musical instrument. They were trying to create an instrument that resonated with the earth and with the universe. And, you know, that was the sophistication of their technology that developed over thousands of years of temple building. And, you know, how do you do that? And why are you doing it? Well, you're trying to explore this other realm. And the temples were a resonator, an outward resonator for the inner temple of your brain. And you're resonating it with sound and acoustics and chemicals. So it's a strange sort of transformative technology that I think they were trying to build with the rituals inside the temple and then with the temple architectures themselves and integrating those with the earth. Those are just some frequencies and that are out there. And I don't know if that made any sense, but again, different frequencies apply for different things depending on what you're trying to achieve.
It definitely makes sense. So that, you know, I think it's kind of an inspiration for their, they must have been inspired to have that extreme intention in what they were creating. And I think that inspiration that we can look at in the psychedelic world might be some inspiration that we could use now, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
And yeah, just to wrap up here, Richard, I mean, one of the things that keeps me coming back to your work is this emphasis that the universe is more like a creative instrument than a meaningless machine. And I think that is really a new conception of ourselves that people should at least think about. And it's not a dogmatic thing. People can put that in so many different couch that in different languages, words, phrases, but this idea that the point of life is creativity, it's not pointless competition, it's actually self-actualization. It's all these things. It's humans are the ultimate symbolic creature, and to deny our relationship with symbol and kind of these higher questions and these philosophical questions that people might tell you never to look at. In fact, it's the only thing that's relevant, I think, to humanity. I mean, it's what we do. It's what we do. It's denying our very nature.
Yeah.
And to say that, oh, we have to become hyper-rational or we have to do this or that to gain control of ourselves so that we'll never commit atrocities and all this nonsense while we, you know, drop depleted uranium on children halfway around. You know what I mean? It's just the hypocrisy and the nonsense. It makes no sense. And I'm at least glad that there's someone speaking to like the truth of, hey, humans, this is a part of us and it's in our history. There's no running away from it. It keeps repeating itself over and over again. You can see it in secular society everywhere. There's no escaping it. It's who we are. And, And so, yeah, no more repression, I say. I think that just leads to dysfunction and whatnot. So I guess in wrapping up, I know we've talked on Vajra sequence and we've even touched on harmonic evolution, but I mean, are you giving any lectures coming up? Are you doing any traveling? What are your plans in the near future?
No, not at the moment. I've just, you know, I've had personal things I've had to deal with, family things. And so that I'm just trying to keep as much time as I can to get this writing done, you know? And, so I'm in that mode right now. And then once I start coming out of that, then, you know, I'll start looking at, getting out in the world again. So anyway, thanks for having me here, and, always enjoy talking with you. It's a lot of fun. You know, we're of like minds, and I'm glad you're plugging into, all the different people that are trying to make sense of it and getting that out. So I wish you well on that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And just, again, very few people integrate as well as you do. And so I encourage everyone to read all your books. I know Interference is kind of hard to get now, but you have a free version of it on your site, amazingly, that anyone can just open up and read. So I guess we'll leave it at that. And Richard, thanks again, and take care.
Thanks a lot, John. See you, Thomas.
Thanks, Richard.